You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio, opening today with Paul Hardcastle's wildly popular 1985 dance hit called 19. We'll hear more from Hardcastle during our show today as we talk with Joan Nabar, a mental health therapist and mother of Sam, a National Guardsman in Duluth, Minnesota. We'll also talk with Michael William, a National Guard resistor who is part of the cutting-edge Iraq and Afghanistan veteran community, creating meaningful and socially conscious work after their experiences with the U.S. military. Michael works at Coffee Strong, a GI-supporting business right outside Fort Lewis in Washington State. First, an update on the San Francisco Board of Education that voted over 2 years ago to phase out Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps, that's JROTC, scheduled to end this June at all seven San Francisco high schools. The school board will not restore JROTC if the program does not have PE credit, because the school district would be forced to pay $1 million per year for just a handful of JROTC cadets. I reported last week that this fight has moved to Sacramento, where three bills have been introduced in the assembly in an attempt to turn the tide in the Pentagon's favor. AB 351 would reverse the bipartisan effort to fight the decline in physical fitness among our youth and would dangerously weaken PE standards in California. 351 would allow school boards to ignore the health and safety of our youth and allow them to grant PE credit to JROTC cadets. State law requires that PE, physical education credit, only be given for classes that include PE curriculum and are taught by credentialed PE teachers. AB 351 creates several exemptions to the standard, allowing school districts to give PE credit to JROTC cadets and to certain other classes that don't meet PE standards, such as marching band, drill team, color guard, and cheerleaders. AB 351 is now before the State Assembly and could be voted on at any time as it is classed as an emergency bill. This means that it takes effect immediately upon being passed by both the Assembly and the Senate and signed by the governor. This also means that it requires a two-thirds majority to pass. The Pentagon is in a big hurry to save its San Francisco program before it ends in June. There's also Assembly Bill 554, which goes one better than 351 and allows JROTC cadets to skip not only PE classes but also art and foreign language studies. This bill is currently scheduled for a hearing before the Assembly Education Committee on April 22nd. Assemblywoman Ma has also introduced AB 223 that would require San Francisco to keep the JROTC program, and it would make San Francisco the only city in the nation required by law to have JROTC. Ma's bill is a clear violation of local control of schools, and even many JROTC supporters oppose it. Every concerned person in California needs to act on these bills by faxing your assembly person. If you can't fax a letter, then call their office and follow that up by putting a letter in the mail or sending an email or doing both. If you don't know who your assembly representative is or need contact information, check your local telephone book or check online at www.assembly.ca.gov. That's www.assembly.ca.gov. Earlier this week, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates announced that he will seek additional funding in the Department of Defense budget to build and sustain an additional 15 Predator and Reaper unmanned aerial vehicles. This will be a 62% increase in the military's capability to utilize drones in ongoing warfare. Gates' comments followed up on President Obama's earlier decisions to, number one, continue attacks along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, including attacks into Pakistan itself, and two, to increase troop levels first by 17,000, followed by another 4,000 troops. And President Obama is seeking over $80 billion in additional supplemental funds for this fiscal year alone, which ends on September 30th, to fight the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. $80 billion in supplemental funds, not what we expected from President Obama. It turns out that the control center for these Predator attacks is right here in Nevada's Creech Air Force Base in Indian Springs, which is also home to the Air Force personnel who remotely control the Predator and Reaper drones used in the Afghanistan-Pakistan war. These latest high-tech weapons use unmanned serial systems, that is UASs, to carry out surveillance and increasingly lethal attacks in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Since many civilians are killed along with unintended targets, these missions are succeeding in their intent to provoke a violent response, even as they fail to pacify or demoralize the target communities. Once unmanned aerial vehicles become airborne in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan, teams inside trailers at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada begin to control them. The MQ-1 Predator and the MQ-9 Reaper drones both function to collect information through surveillance and both carry weapons. The MQ-9 Reaper drone, which the USAF refers to as a hunter-killer vehicle, can carry two 500-pound bombs as well as several Hellfire missiles. On April 9th, 14 social activists were arrested at the gates of Creech Air Force Base during a 10-day vigil. These activists were participating in the Sacred Peace Walk, organized by the Nevada Desert Experience, and they arrived at Creech in the late afternoon after walking 14 miles to the test site. With the vigil's numbers strengthened by the walkers, participants gathered together to reflect upon the lessons to be learned from the examples of the White Rose student movement in Nazi Germany and Dietrich Bonhoeffer's work to oust Hitler from power through a coup attempt. Now, you may recall the White Rose movement distributed flyers calling upon the German people to actively resist their country's continuation of the war and to work for the downfall of Hitler. For this act, many were executed. Dietrich Bonhoeffer himself returned to Germany from the safety of the United States to participate in overthrowing Hitler. Bonhoeffer said his decision to return rather than riding out the war in the U.S. was to make clear to the German people that the choice before them was to work for a German victory in the war and thereby destroy civilization, or to work for Germany's defeat such that civilization might survive. He could not, he said, make this choice from the safety of the U.S., but must return to Germany to act upon his convictions despite the risks. Those arrested at Nevada had been studying the White Rose movement, and when they got to the Nevada Air Force Base, they entered the main gate at Creech Air Force Base, which had been accidentally left open. Air Force security personnel immediately ordered the 14 to stop and to leave the base. Instead, they sat down to diffuse any tension in the air, yet firmly informed the Air Force personnel that they intended to remain and were in fact seeking a conversation with the men and women who work and serve at Creech regarding the ongoing use of the Predator and Reaper drones. Their request to have a conversation was turned down. There's a lot more to the story, and you can learn about the Creech Air Force Base and the action against the drones at the Nevada Desert Experience website, www.nevadadesertexperience.org. Speaking to us from Minnesota today is Joan Nabar, mother of Sam, a National Guardsman from that state. Joan Nabar is also a mental health therapist. She began by telling the story of Sam's enlisting in the Guard.
Well, my son joined, you know, like a lot of young people, to help with college tuition in about 2005. He completed his basic training, and then his plan was to go back to college where he was a junior. And we found out literally days before that he was being selected to go to Iraq, which meant he was leaving for training in 5 days. So he had to withdraw from college.
And at that point, had he known that he was eligible for deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan?
There was some talk of it, but initially it was unknown. So really, he didn't have much notice. He really thought he was going to school in fall, and instead he was on his way for training. And this was after Hurricane Katrina, so they had to go to training in Mississippi right after the hurricane went through. So he ended up training for 6 months, and his deployment lasted, with all of his training, his deployment lasted 2 years. He was in Iraq for 16 months. 15 in Baghdad, and it was before and during the surge when so many soldiers were being killed.
And so he came back, and did you notice any difference in Sam?
Of course. I mean, his unit, they're one of the longest consecutively deployed units in the history of the Guard. They were a combat unit. And they did, his particular group he was with, he did almost between 290 and 300 combat patrols. So, you know, when you say the word reintegration to help somebody adjust from that for the soldiers as well as their families, it's, you know, it's an unimaginable adjustment.
Probably doing patrols a couple of times a day.
Oh, right. Right. I mean, and they, this was Baghdad. I mean, there were a lot of bombings were and being shot at was an everyday occurrence. And I mean, so it was incredibly dangerous. Mm-hmm. And there were 2,600 soldiers of his whole unit, but with his group in Iraq, there was only about 40 of them were in Baghdad. The rest were in Fallujah, which was equally as intense, if not more, at that time.
So am I correct in thinking that some of the National Guardsmen that he trained with remained in Minnesota and others were deployed to Iraq, or did the whole unit go?
The whole unit went. The whole unit went. So it was the largest deployment since World War II. And so, I mean, it was very tough for families. The real struggle is you're not with any support group. And when they return to the community. So, I mean, that is another one of the real intense struggles. You know, I mean, the adjustment is incredibly challenging.
I think that's an important point to emphasize here is with some of the combat units, the active Army combat units, for example, they actually go through some kind of decompression. They go back to Kuwait and they spend a couple of weeks there before they come back to the States. But you're saying that the National Guardsmen don't do that. They come directly back and then right into their
communities? I mean, Minnesota was more organized than most states, so they did have a week debriefing at Camp Ripley. But when you've been, think about it. And when you've been shot at for a year and a half, even a week debriefing it's the tip of the iceberg. But, you know, after being gone that long, they really, you know, they did the best they could and they couldn't keep soldiers any long because they hadn't seen their families. And so they come back to the community and, you know, it's incredibly challenging for everybody.
And you're a mental health professional, so you were actually able to understand some of what he had gone through.
Right. I mean, that's what, you know, that's the other piece that I find so disturbing is that just because you come up with this word reintegration, the reality is it's hell. What I think, because I talked to other families, you know, my son was home and I saw the struggles he was going through, but when I talked to other moms, their emotions and the gamut of feelings they were going through kind of were real similar to mine. So finally, your loved one is home, and you're crying, you're angry. I mean, you're not expressing that toward your loved one, but finally you're able to let down emotionally, and everything comes flooding out. So I think another challenging piece of this is then soldiers are coming home to family members that have secondary trauma, and they're emotional as well. I mean, you have to deal with the fact that, first of all, you're so blessed to have your loved one home. Then the reality is they've been gone for 2 years, and everything has changed, as well as they've changed. And so trying to pick up the pieces and reconnect, the emotional reconnection is really challenging because they've been wired differently from the war, and you have your own secondary trauma. And so what I'm saying is it's a very emotional, challenging time for everyone. And your loved one needs you. To me, it's like the hurricane. The outside piece is the war. The eye of the storm is when they come home. But then you have to make it through the other side of the eye of the hurricane, and that's called reintegration. So reintegration is a catchphrase for something that's an incredibly challenging journey for it, that's different for every soldier and every family.
And what you did was you started talking with other moms, and then you created a project called Voices Not Heard.
Well, I'm working on that project right now. I mean, some of the things I did is, you know, I moved to be near a support group of women and who were also going through what I was going through. So I was in that group, and I did comic stories, but I did a lot of writing. And so as a result of my poetry and the women I met, I decided that I really wanted to tell the stories of the women I've met, and I met a lot of amazing mothers, and perform their stories either with them or without them, depending on what they're comfortable with, because the stories are so compelling. I'd go to the meeting through the most difficult part of the deployment. There may be 30, 40 women around a table with a few fathers. Mm-hmm. And you would go around and everybody would talk about what's going on with their child. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're hearing these stories. And we all live through the extension together. I mean, we found out about the extension from the press. And we found out before our loved ones found out that loved ones are being extended 4 months.
Uh-huh.
So at this point, it was January. We thought our loved ones were coming home in March. Then we find out in January they won't be home till July.
Wow.
You can imagine the pain. So in a meeting, you would go around and you'd hear the stories of the very first meeting I went to on either side of me, there were women who were National Guard mothers whose sons had traumatic brain injuries, and they continued to be deployed. And then they were sent back out. So one of the women I met, the very first, her son had lived through 2 explosions, so he was exposed to 2 traumatic brain injuries. So you hear those stories, and at the same time, you're passing around cards for mothers whose kids have been wounded, or we'd pass around cards for soldiers from Minnesota who had been killed, because there were those who were killed as a result of this deployment and many who were wounded. And occasionally there'd be cards passed around for soldiers who came home and committed suicide. So you can't imagine the incredible scene of these women and their faces and their stories. And that has just moved me. And that, you know, that's, my son will be home 2 years this July. So I really want to honor the voices of the stories and the women that I met during that time by telling some of their stories in a performance piece. And that will be called Voices Not Heard, because in all honesty, I mean, mothers are so torn about what to do. Should they protest? Should they be quiet? How can they cope? And so you don't hear a lot of their stories or their voices. And when you have a loved one deployed, you hear incredible, difficult stories and stories of survival and triumph as well. And I just think it's important to listen to these voices of women, because these are stories we haven't heard.
Talk a little bit about that paradox that the mothers are stuck in between, with the wanting to talk, wanting to protest, and then feeling constrained because their son or daughter is still in the military somehow.
Well, of course, a lot of families feel like there's that whole retribution thing you fear. And I joined Military Families Speak Out kind of early on because I felt like I had to stay sane. And then individually, I personally decided I would speak out against the Iraq War, and I would do it in certain ways just to keep my sanity. And other parents I talked to said a similar thing, that so the thought went through my mind, if my son did not come home and I didn't speak out, I couldn't live with myself. But I felt like there were some things I could do within reason. You know, I didn't want to communicate to him that I did not love him, or I did not understand that he was in a very, I mean, he was in combat. He was in Baghdad. He was being shot at. Mm-hmm. I mean.
Exactly, yeah.
But on the other hand, the policies and the extension and how the soldiers were being treated and all those concerns, I just decided I had to speak out in some ways. And so that's what I did. But a lot of moms, you know, you're just so torn. And then some moms might be called unpatriotic. And so you're in terrible agony. I mean, when you have a child that's deployed, you know, Americans like to say that things are happening. They use this phrase, things are happening in real time. Well, war, I mean, life is in real time. War is in real time. So every day is agony for a mother or father or loved one who has someone deployed. And when you know that, you know, for example, you know, I can only imagine what parents who have a loved one deployed in Afghanistan right now are feeling. I mean, my son was in Baghdad during the surge when 122 soldiers sometimes were dying a month. Mm. And you never know when your son or daughter is going to call, so you keep a cell phone with you. And occasionally you notice a change in their voice, and they might say, well, I've got a mission coming up. And you know from how they talk and what they say that it's, you know, it could be something dangerous. And so what I'm saying is you're living with that internally, and then you have to go to work, and people around you have no comprehension of what your daily reality is.
Barely even know that there's a war on, in fact, sometimes.
No. And see, I was working as a therapist at the time, and one of the occasions I was with some other therapists at a meeting. And even though these were like very professionally trained, well-educated people, a mental health professional said to me, Joan, is it true that the guys on the front lines have low IQs? And I was speechless. So mothers are going through this, what can I do to keep my sanity, to honor my son, yet what do I feel like I need to do as a mom? I mean, most of us would not think of getting between a mother bear and her cub, because the reality is that bond is so fierce, we know she would do everything in her power to protect her young. Why should an American mother be any different? So when I would hear the word, you're not patriotic or whatever, I would think, that's not my reality. To me, I had to honor where I was at. And I could also respect mothers who felt that they could not speak out, because, in fact, it could jeopardize your child. I mean, somebody could lash out at your child.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that when you went to these meetings, it was mostly women and mothers, but you said there were a couple of fathers there.
Yes.
There seems to be more of a constraint upon the men, doesn't? At least in my opinion, there seems to be more constraint upon the men about speaking out. You see fewer of them. When the ones that do show up are quite vocal, it's true. But the women tend to be much more likely to get into a group and to support one another in the way that you've described the women in your community.
Right.
Being.
Right. I mean, I think mothers and fathers suffer, and I think they do different things about it. And I think, like you said, women tend to find other mothers they can be with, and either, you know, and I did the same, you know, you send out packages, but then sometimes you also demonstrate or speak out. Well, I think as a mother, and this is in honor of Mother's Day, I mean, mother, you know, it's a visceral connection you have with your loved one. And to me, part of being a mother is this bond of protection. And, you know, it's an ancient thing. How many mothers since the beginning of time would want their child to be killed, wounded, or risk their life for senseless war?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I, you know, being in a group helped, writing helped. Occasionally I would stand with a sign somewhere. One Mother's Day, I stood with a sign at the Capitol building in St. Paul, and I had a red cloth, and on the red cloth I had white roses, and I thought this month, and it was for Mother's Day, so I stood there alone with this red cloth and white roses, and I just stood there for an hour because I thought this is going to be my way to keep my sanity this Mother's Day. And this man comes up to me with these two little towhead kids, and he's well-dressed, and he says, what are you doing? And I said, well, my son is in Iraq, and I'm just standing here to honor him and the other soldiers serving there. And he looked at me, he said, well, I'm rich, and I'm never going to have to worry about my kids serving, and he walked away. I mean, it was so bizarre. But then his little daughter came back and reached out her hand to me. She was like 3 years old, so because she could see the kids can connect emotionally, so she could see I was just standing there in some kind of pain doing that. So she kind of reached out her hand, and he just turned on his heel and walked away. So I think the agony of the Iraq deployments or these deployments, the other part is that there's 1% of Americans that are carrying this burden. And the rest of Americans, at times, some of us have felt like you've turned on your heel and walked away.
Well, and this feeds into what you said about the other therapist that you work with who asked about the IQ of the people that enlist.
Right, right. Because not only did that mental health professional say that, then another one said, well, you know, they're all the same or something like that. And it was all I could do to keep from screaming. And at this point, my son was in his last days of his deployment, and it was getting really bad. And he was helping search for some soldiers who had been kidnapped, and it's 122 degrees there. And my coworkers are making comments like this to me.
You're 18 years old, and you're wearing somebody's brains around on your shirt because they got their head blown off right next to you. And that's not supposed to affect you. I can never understand. What would scare me is if we were to send a group of 18-year-olds 12,000 miles away and subject them to a year of that obscenity and have them not be affected. That's what would frighten me.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. We're talking to Joan Nabar, mother of Sam, a Minnesota National Guardsman who was deployed to Iraq for 16 months. Joan Nabar is also a mental health professional, and she goes on here to talk about the lack of awareness amongst her colleagues, friends, and the general U.S. population not directly involved in issues of war and peace and who don't make it their duty to learn more.
When soldiers come home, you're trying to heal in an environment that is emotionally disconnected from what you've been through, and they continue to be emotionally disconnected. Mm-hmm. And maybe if they knew more, they would be say and do more sensitive things. If you say, we support the troops or whatever, that means nothing. It's action. Actions speak louder than words. So you do things. You act in a compassionate way. You do things that are compassionate. You make sure families know they're not alone. You offer to help. You offer to listen. It's not about having to donate money. It's about the emotional connection and what can I do, not just waving a flag or sticking a yellow sticker on your car.
It's also about educating yourself to know exactly how the military works, doesn't it? So the amount of money that goes into the military, who gets signed up, how they get signed up, you know,
right.
What that whole recruitment thing is about.
Right.
All of those things are part of being a citizen, I think, and we're not really getting that.
No, I mean, a lot of times when I just mentioned I had a son deploy, I mean, a lot of people don't know that they don't know anything about the deployment or what you've been through or the reintegration or what happened, you know, when our loved ones got extended. So what I'm saying is, how can you ask military families to heal or soldiers to heal when Americans are completely emotionally disconnected? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you've lived through hell. I mean, it's crazy making is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah.
It's very crazy making. So when I hear that there's 1,000 return soldiers a day attempting suicide, it breaks my heart, but I'm not shocked. If you know anything about mental health, basic mental health, or human development, how can you imagine that a human being can live through numerous deployments in urban guerrilla warfare in a civil war, where there are millions of people, men, women, and children around, civilians, you don't know who is who.
You don't speak the language. You don't know the culture.
No, no. And then you're there for a year and a half, mm-hmm. several deployments, you're stop lost, and you come back, and soldiers are struggling, and families are struggling, and people are having suicide attempts. To me, it was a recipe prefer disaster. As a mental health professional, it's another thing I found horrifying is that how can we act surprised now?
Right. And I have this theory, Joan Nabar, tell me what you think of it as a therapist, is the soldiers themselves, the troops themselves, need to be talking a lot more about what they went through. They tend to hold it in, and I think part of their role when they're, you know, when they're, I don't know if rehabilitated is the word we want to use, but when they're feeling up to it, is to actually start talking really about what went on in war and begin to educate the population.
But you know what? They need to do that in a safe and trusting environment. Mm-hmm. And so they need to find, because for sure most soldiers aren't going to want to tell mom and dad, going to want to tell their husband or wife or brother or sister, because, you know, what I hear is you don't understand. And the reality is I know that that's true. So they need to find safe places where they can talk. That's very true. And so that might be through a vet center. A lot of communities have those. It might be through the VA, or it might be through private counselors. There's a lot of people in private practice that will volunteer time, because sometimes soldiers want to talk to somebody in the VA, and sometimes they don't because they're afraid it might go in their permanent file and somehow it will come back to harm their future work. Mm-hmm. But yes, you're right. It's very important to find ways to talk. I mean, one thing I did and that other communities can do is there's a retreat center here in my city of Duluth, and it's a non-denominational thing, and I said, listen, you know, as a mom, I've been struggling, and I'm wondering if you would do a retreat for women touched by the war. And so they did it. They offered just a little weekend retreat, and we advertised. I did the advertising, and we had 13 women come. It was 2 days, one overnight. There were scholarships, so anybody could come. Half of the women who came were wives of Vietnam veterans.
Interesting.
Half of them.
Yeah.
And there's so much healing that needs to be done physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever your spiritual practice is. If communities could reach out and offer that to families or to soldiers, there's so much that needs to be healed and talked about. And one thing that you long for after that kind of a brutal experience is you just long for compassion and acceptance and validation and nurturing. So much of that needs to happen for soldiers and for their families, just a place where they can feel validated and talk, where soldiers can talk, and where they can feel safe, as well as for families.
That was Joan Nabar, mother of Minnesota National Guardsman who was deployed to Iraq, and a mental health professional who finds a real lack of awareness about troops and war among her mental health colleagues.
According to a Veterans Administration study, half of the Vietnam combat veterans suffer from what psychiatrists call post-traumatic stress disorder. Many vets complain of alienation, rage, or guilt. Some succumb to suicidal thoughts. 8 to 10 years after coming home, almost 800,000 men are still fighting the Vietnam War.
You're invited to listen to the voices of those whose families are affected by war by joining me over the next few weeks as I launch my new book, Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror. Here you can hear the voices of those in the U.S. and also in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Israel, West Bank, and Iraqi refugees in Damascus, Syria. I collected these verbatim stories by traveling to these countries over the last 4 years while my own son was deployed to 3 tours in the combat zone. These stories really bring home the reality that so many people are facing around the world. Some are heartbreaking stories of families losing their homes and other family members to bombings and bulldozers, and all highlight the resilience of these families who refuse to give up on the possibility of peace. The book tour begins in the San Francisco Bay Area on April 28th at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. Then I'm off to Portland, Seattle, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, Boston, and Northampton, Massachusetts. Every event will have speakers representing these communities and raising awareness about the ongoing effects of war in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the United States. You can go to the book's website for more info or to buy the book, www.mothersspeakaboutwarandterror.org. You can also go to this show's website for more information. That's www.raisingsandradio.org. Let's go now to Michael William in Washington State, where he's a war resistor on the cutting edge of GI-supported business. We talked to Michael at his place of work, Coffee Strong, where active-duty troops from the nearby military base come for coffee and mix with veterans, resistors, and their families. Michael went to the National Guard in 2006 and departed in 2007, and I asked him why he joined the Guard.
I joined the National Guard because I wanted to continue my education at the University of Washington. I wanted to finish up my degree. I was very close to getting my degree in English there, and I simply ran out of money because of medical bills, and I felt like I didn't have any other options with getting back into school. And it was a pretty low point in my life as far as very dear friend was raped, and my cat died, and another friend died, like all within a month. And I wasn't really in the best state of mind, and I thought that, you know, joining the military was, you know, a good option for the situation I was in. And I didn't really consider the implications of what I would be trained to do.
Mm-hmm. When did you realize what you were being trained to do?
Well, since I joined as a cook, I was pretty naive. I thought that I wasn't really going to be training to take part in any combat situations.
Mm-hmm.
However, when I joined my National Guard unit, I scored expert with the 50 caliber machine gun, and my staff sergeant told me that that's what I was going to be doing in Iraq, that I would be manning a 50 caliber machine gun on a truck.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't like the first time that it became, you know, that I understood that that's what I'd be doing. Even during basic training, even during advanced initial training, it was pretty well understood, or at least we were told that cooks were not going to be cooking in Iraq, that they just did whatever was needed, including going out on convoys, you know, doing a tower duty, any number of things. So, that, you know, didn't involve cooking in the least. The reason for that is that Kellogg Brown and Root contractors do all the cooking, and they do a lot of the support jobs that are historically positions filled by enlisted military. Now, the American taxpayers, they're paying to train all of these support members in the armed services to do jobs, you know, that they're never going to actually complete.
Mm-hmm.
Those jobs are being performed by third world nationals coming into Iraq as contractors to, you know, work very cheaply for the same job that, you know, that American troops were trained for.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what you're saying is in the old days, I guess this used to be called kitchen patrol. You'd be in the troops, the enlisted people would be in there peeling potatoes and washing dishes and stuff. And now
mm-hmm.
it's all contractors.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because my experience is the average American who's not got a family member or who doesn't know very much about the military really doesn't even realize that this is going on. They think that the military is the same old thing that it's always been, and folks are peeling potatoes as they always have done. But in fact, as you discovered, it is done all by contractors.
Well, I mean, I have never been in Iraq. I haven't had the firsthand experience. But generally what I've heard from everyone who has come into contact with, you know, the situation is that KBR is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They do so many of the positions, not just cooking, but all of the quartermaster kind of positions, a lot of radio operations. You know, I saw a very small portion of what it was like to be in the military, but yeah, I would say that this is not very widely known. A lot of times when people hear civilian contractors, they think of groups like Blackwater, who do security contracting, but having civilians take these non-combat jobs that are generally, you know, performed by service members, that frees them up to, you know, fill combat-related roles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how many, what the current number is, but at one point there was 190,000 civilian contractors in Iraq when there were only 170,000 soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Having that large number of civilian contractors allows us to carry on this operation in Iraq without, you know, a larger military force. That was all part of Rumsfeld's plan, was to have like a smaller force going in and fulfilling, you know, these military operations and not really needing to rely on public support. If we had a larger public, you know, support for the war in Iraq, then they wouldn't have to rely on stop loss, they wouldn't have to rely on extended tours of duty, they wouldn't have to rely on hiring civilian contractors to perform these jobs. That support is evidently not there.
Using the contractors also really hides the severity of what's going on over there, because there are very few tallies of how many contractors are dying, because, in fact, they come from all over the world. They come from South Africa. I know people that have family members in Iraq from South Africa. They come from all over. And so the numbers of people that are actually dying are really much greater than the average person even begins to realize. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's right. One of the most frustrating things for a lot of veterans, especially those that are actively involved with groups such as Iraq Veterans Against the War and GI Voice, is just the lack of awareness in the greater public. Many people are unaware that there are two wars going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
People are unaware that, you know, there are still deployments going on and that there are still people dying. Beyond that, there are a lot of other issues the military service members are facing, which, you know, the public just doesn't really seem to know about.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford, talking on the phone to Michael William at Coffee Strong in Washington State. We can hear in the background that there's a lot of activity going on there. And talk to our listeners about the kinds of systems that the troops, the active duty, and the veterans and the resistors are setting up around the country.
Coffee Strong is definitely an anti-war establishment. We've got a large banner advertising Iraq Veterans Against the War. This is support war resistors. And so it has the general feel, like it's very evident of where we're coming from politically. But generally when active duty people come in, the first thing that we try to do is lead them to our resource table. We have everything from Getting Out, it's a guide to military discharges, cards for the GI Rights Hotline, information to get in contact with a sexual assault advocate who will help men and women who have been sexually assaulted in the military to get out as quickly as they need to you know, get to some kind of safe base so that, you know, they're immediately removed from that danger. There's also free and confidential counseling for all veterans and active duty members through this network of local and I think the program is actually nationwide right now, but it's called the Soldiers Project.
Uh-huh.
And that that offers, like I said, soldiers, veterans, and military family free counseling. And that's unlimited, which is much better than what the VA offers. The VA will offer up to like 10 sessions for free. And then people are expected to pay after that.
Yes. They are?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. So 10 sessions free at the VA, and then after that you're on your own nickel.
That's right. And a lot of people don't want to do such things like that, because you know, there will be a paper trail, and if they're considering staying in the military, there are concerns that that will keep them from going up in rank.
Mm-hmm.
It will keep them from certain positions that they're trying to attain. So having a civilian, like, completely confidential and free program available for them, is it will encourage people to seek out help when otherwise they might, you know, avoid it. And there's another great program. It's actually a DOD program. It's Military Family Counseling. They aren't exactly able to discuss, like, the more political ends of things,
mm-hmm.
but it is confidential. There's no paper trail, so people will go to them for a number of problems that they're facing. And if subjects do come up that they can't discuss, we are here to kind of pick up where they end.
Uh-huh.
So if someone is facing stop loss, or if they're being harassed by their command, if they're being punished unjustly, or if they want to get out of the military, there's the GI Rights Hotline. That's going to help soldiers in those issues
mm-hmm.
that are facing those problems, help them find the best solution for them.
Michael, let me ask you about the active duty soldiers that are coming, because you're very close to Fort Lewis.
Yes, I'm standing inside the cafe right now, and just outside of our parking lot is I-5, the interstate, and just on the other side of that is Fort Lewis.
Hmm.
We are two blocks away from the entrance to Fort Lewis and also Camp Murray.
Hmm.
And the nearby Air Force Station, McCord. So we're kind of surrounded by military posts.
Have any of the officers ever come in and talk to you?
Officers have come in. Some of them, I think a few, have shown displeasure in what we're doing. But for the most part, we don't get too many officers here anymore. I think that might just be from my cold disposition towards them. We treat lieutenants all right, but once they get past captain, they're kind of, you know, once they get towards the field grade officer level, they're not really the best people.
Do you ever get active duty soldiers coming in that are ask you what you're doing, and or do they come in only when they're really kind of friendly towards the situation?
Well, I mean, we've seen an increase of all sorts of activity. We every single person comes in and is reacting to it in a different way, it seems.
Uh-huh.
I had this one National Guard soldier come in. She had been in for, I think, 24 years. So
mm-hmm.
she was in it for life, you know. And
yeah.
At first she asked if she was in the right place, because she saw a large Iraq Veterans Against the War sign. I talked to her about the resources that we offer and, you know, made her a drink. Gave it to her for free. Actually, she was just getting coffee. We actually give free drip or Americanos to all enlisted. And since she was enlisted, you know,
mm-hmm.
I gave her free coffee, and she really liked that. And she was really excited about the resources we were offering. And her first impression of the place was that, you know, she wanted to turn right around and walk out. And she ended up, you know, shaking my hand and thanking us for what we were doing. And, you know, I've had other situations like that. Someone who was 19 and a half years through their service. That means they were 6 months away from retiring. In the military, after 20 years, that's when you're able to retire and receive retirement benefits. He was being stop-lossed, so his contract was being extended past his retirement to go do another tour in Iraq. And even he walked out of here with the GI Rights Hotline number, so, and he was also very happy with what we were doing. And those are two cases where I really did not expect that mid-level NCOs to be really appreciating what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so that was nice. But we generally get lower rank, lower level enlisted coming in. And, you know, there's a lot of mixed reactions, but I think people are really enjoying. And they're very happy about what we're doing here. We also do a number of concerts here. We've had a dozen or so since we opened last November 4th. And they're always free with military ID. You know, we try to do as many events as possible to entertain the troops. We have an open mic coming up just next week. It'll be our second one.
Are you able to fully support yourself there, or do you get some donation?
You mean, like, are we able to support ourselves as a business or
a
person?
Yeah, well, as financially.
We rely on donations at this point. We are very quickly expanding as far as, like, our business. We are always seeing increases in the day-to-day sales. And I think that soon enough we will be completely financially stable and, you know, able to be self-sustaining. But up until that point, we still rely on sustaining donors and other donations.
Mm-hmm.
Every single thing that we have in here has been donated to us, including a piano. We've got all the furniture, all the computers. We have an espresso machine that was donated to us. Stumptown Coffee Roasters that roast out of Seattle and Portland. They give us coffee for free.
Oh,
and that's what allows us to give free Americanos and drip coffee to the enlisted. We wouldn't be able to do this without all of that support. And if people want to find out how they can help us, I mean, visiting givoice.org or simply coffeestrong.com, either one of those, it's kind of run through the same website. I mean, they can see how they can help us. And sustaining donations is really what helps us out month to month. But right now, I'm the only paid employee at Coffee Strong. I will be here 4 days out of the week, and we have veteran volunteers who cover the other 3 days. I really would like the other volunteers to be paid for their work. I mean, they do a lot for Coffee Strong.
I'll make sure that we get a link up to givoice.org and coffeestrong.com so that listeners can go and learn more and do whatever they can do to help. There was Michael William at Coffee Strong, located outside two military bases in Washington State. I'll be at Coffee Strong in the afternoon of May 2nd to meet these folks, share the stories in my book, Long Time Passing, and bring you stories from Coffee Strong in Washington State. You can learn more about the event at www.mothersspeakaboutwarandterror.org or go to Coffee Strong at coffeestrong.com and givoice.org. You can also go to the show's website for more information. I'll have links on it. That's www.raisingsandradio.org. And that's our show for today. As usual, views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU Stanford. We'll go out with Paul Hardcastle's music, 19, a reminder that when it comes to war, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
They fought the longest war in American history. They fought the longest war in American history. In 1965, Vietnam seemed like just another foreign war. But it wasn't. It was different in many ways, and so were those who did the fighting. In World War II, the average age of the combat soldier was 26. In Vietnam, he was 19. 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 19.
Wasn't really sure what was going on. 19.
to send a group of 18-year-olds 12,000 miles away and subject them to a year of that obscenity and have them not be affected. That's what would frighten me.
I wasn't really sure what was going on.